I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Marvin Heyer, founder and dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This fine spring morning, it's clear that whether you are a Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox Jew, Passover is now absolutely over. And it's time to return to eating bagels, challah, cookies, and leavened baked goods of all varieties, and to take out and store the Passover crockery and bring back the regular cookware and food. As we returned our own home kitchen to its year-round chametz status, we discovered, as we do annually, that we still had several boxes of uneaten matzah. You see, you buy the 5 pounds of matzah because it's a much better deal, and you need a couple of boxes for the Seder anyway, and by the time Passover's over, you always end up with a couple of boxes left, just when you don't really want to see matzah again for a very long time. So how do you use up all that unleavened bread of intestinal affliction? While I, who really don't like matzah, maybe you figured that out, might suggest a large matzah bonfire for Lag BaOmer, singer Michelle Citrin, a past guest of Two Jewish, can tell you 20 better things to do with matzah after Passover.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Catch it like a frisbee with your friends in the park, or you could jump in the water and pretend you're a shark. You can make a matzah pick and play the guitar, and you can make a matzah license plate for your car. Use it as a coaster when you're drinking your beer, or you can throw it for a happy new year.
Insulate.
Decorate.
9. Exfoliate.
10.
Constipate. Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Crumble up some matzah to line your hamster cage, or you can use it as a bookmark to hold your page. Break a stack of matzah when you practice your karate. Build a matzah doghouse for your doggy named Scotty. Make a little matzah board and wave it goodbye, or you can make a pair of matzah wings and learn how. Wear some matzah jewelry, make a picture frame for me, have a drink of matzah tea. Matzah's all that I can see. There's just one more thing to do with unleavened bread. You can eat it, 'cause it ain't all that bad.
That was Michelle Citrin's 20 Things to Do with Matzah After Passover's Over. If Passover's now over, and it totally is, that means we are in the period of the counting of the Omer, the time between Pesach, the festival of freedom, and Shavuot, the holiday of covenant and Torah. For the 7 weeks between Pesach and Shavuos, we take a few moments every evening to say a blessing and count the days that lead us towards a reaffirmation of our brit, our covenant with God, as certified at Mount Sinai. As the passage in Proverbs says, teach us to number our days so that we can make each day count. The counting of the Omer reminds us that we have the capacity to make every single day matter, to bring holiness into our lives every day. During this period, we commemorate some unique days of observance in Jewish history. The first of these is Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, coming up this Thursday. Yom HaShoah is a modern addition to the Jewish calendar, of course, and the origin of this special day bears retelling. In the aftermath of the Holocaust and the annihilation of half the Jews in the world at the hands of the Nazis and their collaborators, there is discussion about how best to remember the victims of the Germans. In Israel, the debate was between the Orthodox authorities on the one hand and the survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and other partisan fighters who survived the war on the other. The fighters wanted a commemorative day close to the beginning of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which began the first night of Pesach, Passover 1943. The Orthodox authorities, including the renowned scholar the Chazon Ish, refused to allow the joy of Passover's celebration of liberation from slavery to be diminished by a day commemorating the martyrs of Europe. In fact, they did not want Yom HaShoah to be anywhere in the whole month of Nisan, the Jewish month celebrating Passover. After a long and acrimonious two-year debate, a compromise date was arrived at in 1950. It was going to be after the end of Passover, but still within the month of Nisan, the 27th of Nisan. This week we will commemorate the martyrs of the Holocaust on Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, Thursday. Our distinguished guest this morning on Too Jewish, in honor of Yom HaShoah, is Rabbi Marvin Heyer, the founder and dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, creator of the Museum of Tolerance, the first Holocaust museum in the United States, and a two-time Oscar winner as well. Hear Rabbi Heyer's extraordinary story when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We are delighted and honored to introduce our guest this morning on Too Jewish. Rabbi Marvin Heyer is the founder and dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center and an important figure in Jewish life. His new autobiography is called Rabbi Marvin Heyer, Meant to Be Beshert, I guess, a memoir. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you had a variety of careers before this career. You were a congregational rabbi. You founded a yeshiva. When did the Wiesenthal Center become your life's work?
Well, my purpose in coming down to Los Angeles was to create a yeshiva for university students who had no background. And that's exactly what we did. We bought the property here in Los Angeles, and we had attracted 40 to 50 university students. We had dorms for them. And we had purchased this large building. And one day, and as the yeshiva opened, we hired the faculty. We were affiliated with Yeshiva University. We had everything good.
Everything in place.
And what happened was I took my children to the tar pits, which is my wife and children. We went to the tar pits, the place where they have fossils of ancient dinosaurs. And we went on a regular tour. And there was a young girl, as I recall now, my guess was that she was about 11 or 12 years old, and she said to the guide, can the dinosaurs come back? And the guide said to her, no, because of the dramatic change in climate conditions, it would be scientifically impossible for them to come back. And then we toured the tar pits, and on the way home, I was thinking about that. And I said to myself, I wonder what we would answer if the question were a little differently, can human dinosaurs like Adolf Hitler return to the planet Earth? Whether we would certainly not be able to give the answer that the climate conditions have changed, what would the answer be? And I said to myself, you know, the answer is obviously, of course they can come back at any time. And at that time in the United States, we're talking 1977, there was not a single address in the greatest country on the planet to, in you know, like Yad Vashem, to continuously perpetuate the memory of the Shoah every day and to warn people that such a thing is possible. The fact that Hitler's gone doesn't mean there won't be others. And I said to myself, you know what? We're opening yeshiva. That fulfills one obligation to educate young people. But what about the question that one-third of all of world Jewry was wiped out by the Shoah? Can that happen again? And if the answer is it can, what are we doing about it? Why is there no such place in America? And there was born the idea. And when I was a pulpit rabbi in Vancouver, I visited with Simon Wiesenthal. I didn't know him and didn't expect him to be there, but he just came out of his office, said hello to us. That was the only I knew.
This is in Vienna.
In Vienna.
Right.
And at that time, I think on Salta Gasa. And so that was my only encounter. I said to myself, you know what? Why don't we put the full building to use for a great purpose and have half the building open the first Holocaust Center in the United States in a big way, and make that contribution as well, that we would be dealing with the question of reminding people that Adolf Hitler was, you know, Nazism took hold in a cultured country. They could boast the greatest intellectual, cultural stars, but it didn't prevent Auschwitz. And so the fact that we can boast that the United States of America is the greatest civilization, we cannot guarantee, nobody can say, what's going to be here 4,000 years, 1,000 years, 500 years from now? The answer is we simply don't know.
Don't know, right.
So there was born this idea, and I then said, how am I whose name should that bear? A rich donor? I said, no, I think it should bear the name of Simon Wiesenthal, who really never came home from the Holocaust.
And continued to hunt for Nazis
right. Forever. Right.
We will talk much more with Rabbi Marvin Heyer about his new book, Meant to Be, a Memoir, and the Wiesenthal Center. We'll return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends David and Pamela from Freedom Smoke. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So your product is kosher?
Yes. The base ingredients, the propylene glycol vegetable glycerin, are both certified kosher, USP grade. It's basically the same product that's put in asthma inhalers.
Where do you get your flavorings from?
Our flavorings come from Flavor Art in Italy. It is definitely the finest flavorings in the world.
And people have a variety of choices.
Yes, they do. We've got over 500 flavors.
Now, the quality of what you provide is very important.
Yes, it is. When people come in, we first find out what kind of cigarettes they've been using, so we know the approximate level of nicotine they'll need. Then we fit them with a flavor that would be perfect for them.
How can people find out more? Where can they go?
They can do one of a couple of things. They can visit us on our website at freedomsmokeusa.com. That's all one word. Or call us on our 800 number, 800-705-7013.
Thanks so much.
A pleasure.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award in 2016, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio, T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at gmail.com, or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website by streaming them, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We have 6 months until we elect a new president of these United States, and so we continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. As the long presidential primary season grinds towards its summertime conclusion, I must note that we missed a very odd campaign moment a couple of weeks ago in the New York primary. Ohio Governor John Kasich, the long-shot Republican candidate still hanging on in the race, visited Brooklyn's ultimate Orthodox neighborhood, Borough Park, while campaigning in the New York primary. He went to a Jewish bookstore, a Shmura Matzah bakery, and a Jewish day school a couple of weeks ago before the April 19th primary. After lauding the Passover, that's how Christians say it, not Jews, we just say Passover or Pesach, Kasich went on to compare the biblical blood on the doorposts used to ward away the angel of death in Exodus to the blood of Jesus. The great link between the blood that was put above the lampposts. The blood of the Lamb, because Jesus Christ is known as the Lamb of God. It's his blood, we believe, Kasich said to the Hasidim. I hardly know where to start on how bad it was to say this to a group of Orthodox Jews, Hasidim, any Jews, but we can start with the fact that he meant doorposts, not lampposts, and add that Jews don't think the blood of Jesus had a lot to do with the Exodus from Egypt 1,250 years before he was putatively born, or really that Jesus' blood has much to do with Judaism at all. Finally, to emphasize his confused religious point, Kasich shook his parting gift, a box of fragile shmura matzah, super carefully watched and baked to be perfect for Passover. In spite of all that, Kasich actually finished second in New York to Trump, beating out Ted Cruz. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the rise of the far right in Europe and in England last time. Terrorism plays into this. It's Islamist terrorism primarily. At least that's how it's portrayed. I think that's probably valid. Let's talk about how that fits into this whole complicated equation.
Right. Well, at least as of late, the Islamic State has been eager to claim responsibility for horrific massacres in Brussels and Paris and elsewhere. Some of the massacres in Turkey, it's not so clear whether it's really the Islamic State or possibly
Kurdish
the Kurdish Workers' Parties, whatever.
Right.
But several different groups are eager to claim responsibilities for those particular acts of violence. But the fact is that...
And I should note, most of these have not particularly targeted Jews, although some in Turkey did and in Paris to some degree they did.
Right. But the fact is that terrorism can happen anywhere, and it has often the desired effect of creating fear and the undesired effect of reinforcing right-wing extremism and extremist tendencies of let's get tough, let's keep all foreigners out. And this is rhetoric that you can hear in the current primary campaigns. This is rhetoric that you hear all over Europe. Let's kick them all out. Let's get tough. And it's not clear that getting tough actually produces the desired effect, because you can't screen everybody with 100% effectiveness. It's impractical to, quote unquote, kick them all out, send them all home. These are unrealistic political slogans and sort of political bombast, which is heard with increasing frequency, actually, on both sides of the Atlantic. The implications of some of it are scary. It's irresponsible. And it's certainly not a long-term solution. I think Europe initially felt safer than we did. We were scared out of our minds by 9/11. 9/11 was massive and dramatic and really changed the way Americans lived. Think about the difference between going to an airport before 9/11 and after. But a lot of those security precautions were already in place in Europe at the time that 9/11 took place, because in the 80s and 90s, there were terrorist incidents in Europe, in cinemas and discos and department stores. And so there were metal detectors like there are in Israel. And that was kind of already a way of life. So they haven't changed as much. Now, in response to recent events in Brussels, Paris, Madrid, Istanbul, Ankara, and elsewhere, there may be more changes yet to come in Europe. I fear that those changes will be more political and less technical anti-terrorist measures, but only time will tell.
Thanks, Tom. We will hear more about this, I'm sure, for a long time. Talk to you soon.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivinon Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So it's May 1st, and that's May Day, which means absolutely nothing to most Americans. But in Israel, it's still a festival of the workers that's celebrated.
Nachon. So every May 1st, you will see, like, definitely parts of Israel, when the, and at the past even more, I remember it as a kid, people will wear red.
Because they were socialists or communists,
yes.
Probably. Right.
Yes, and they will celebrate all the worker unions and, you know, the right of the employees or workers. And it's we used to be a more parades than celebration, mm-hmm. but it's a day off.
Kind of a May Day day
yeah,
off of
day
labor,
off.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Israel had such a strong socialist background. It was founded mm-hmm. by labor Zionists mm-hmm. who believed that work made us free and changed, created the new Jew, and all this hard physical labor was something that was to be exalted.
Mm-hmm.
The whole economy, not whole, but 60-70% of the economy was nationalized uh-huh. until like the 1970s, really. So
even later.
The whole concept of labor still means something different in Israel to what it does in America, I think.
Yeah, I think even though like the past 20 years we become less and less socialist and privatization took really, and it's since the early 90s, yeah, of the, but it's still, when you talk about labor, as you said, it's like the new Jew. Mm-hmm. The labor represent the new Jew, not those who really only with the sefer, with the cheder.
Yeah.
So it's a value. It's not just, it's a, one of the core values of Israel, not just a political view.
You know, and so it's really across the political spectrum.
Yes.
Even though Avodah, the Labor Party, was, you know, kind of in charge of Israel.
Avodah Ivrit.
Right, right. The Hebrew labor, right? Or
uh-huh.
the Jewish laborer.
Yeah.
That concept may not be there in the same way, but still, I think it almost as a kind of, in the same way that Americans talk about patriots, Israelis talk about, you know, the laborer.
Yes. Yes. If it's the labor and it's to buy kahol lavan, which is to buy products made by Israeli companies.
And by Israeli workers
and
Israeli companies, right?
And to support. It's really... Everything is part of the Zionist concept of build the country, and now that we build it, now to support it and to maintain it and to make sure that it's also the belief that the Hebrew, it's not the Hebrew work, it's the Jewish, like Israeli Jewish worker who will really have loyalty to the country, will support Israel no matter what. So that's... Yeah.
It's an interesting concept. And so I don't know, what do
and
you
it
say?
It makes sense that my father was Likudnik and we celebrated May 1st.
So even though a very right wing.
My mom was labor, my father was
Likud.
My
yeah.
father was Likudnik, but we celebrated May 1st.
Very interesting. So what did you say to people on May 1st?
Was Yom Poalim Sameach.
Yom Poalim Sameach, then.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Tov.
Well, we've passed Pesach, but the lessons go on. We talked about the wise child, the Rasha, the so-called wicked child from the right. Passover Seder. Let's talk about the Tam in our exploration of educational types.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simple child, mm-hmm. or the one who isn't brilliant and isn't rebellious.
Right. Kind of your average kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it comes down to knowing what kids are all about and what makes them tick. There are standards for education. There are certain things that we need to teach. And, you know, they're identified according to children's age and more or less their developmental capacity. So that's a really good starting point right there. How's this child doing developmentally? Are we asking for too much? Are the expectations on target? What's going on with their learning? What are their abilities like, and what are their interests like? And that's one of those keys to unlocking teaching and learning, figuring out what makes a child get excited, what makes a child get engaged and get involved and really light that fire.
You know, every kid has skill in some area, has mm-hmm. talents in one area or another. And a lot of times we focus on the ones who are clearly outstanding or the ones who are really struggling, and we tend to miss
the kids in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting too, because as much as we'd like to see children progress through an educational system and go to college and beyond, not everybody is cut out for that kind of a life. And this could be the Tam child or the Chacham child. Everybody is on their own path. And so from a Jewish education standpoint, it's important that we convey what our value system is all about. What's important? What's our role ethically and morally in the world? Knowing right from wrong, good and bad, how to make moral and ethical decisions. And additionally, how to be a Jew, how to live life as a Jew, how to participate in holidays, the mechanics of knowing what to do. If children want to go to synagogue as they grow up, how they can be involved and participate there too. So there are a lot of nuts and bolts that can be conveyed as children go through their developmental phases. And one of the beautiful things about our culture and our tradition and our practice is that Judaism is very hands-on. So while you might not be able to have a deep intellectual connection or growth, there's still a lot of capacity to participate, to make matzah like we did with our kids.
I was thinking the matzah making we did together, religious school kids from Temple Emmanuel and the THA kids.
And we've talked about building a sukkah, you know, and spinning the dreidel, lighting the candles. There's cooking.
Making challah. You know.
Making challah, prepping the house for Pesach, you know, all that cleaning and setting the Seder table. So there are tons of opportunities for experience and engagement with all kinds of children.
It's a great point. And although we joke that, you know, a Jewish child isn't considered fully human until he graduates from medical school, not everybody's supposed to do that. And
that's
we have
right.
to understand that. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service here in a final post-Passover edition. It was the first night of Pesach this year, and Morris and Susie, together with their sons, 4-year-old Simon and 7-year-old Isaac, were having their annual Seder. Soon it was time for the Manishtana, the four questions read by the youngest child present. Little Simon asked, "Why is this night different from all other nights?" And his older brother Isaac immediately replied, "Because tonight Mommy cooked." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This Shabbat, we read the great portion of Kiddushim, including the Holiness Code, the ethical injunctions that lie at the heart of Jewish practice. Kiddushim includes mitzvot that require us to assist the poor, treat strangers, widows, and orphans with generosity and kindness, obligate sensitivity to those with physical and other impairments, and insists on fair business practices. It directs us to live moral lives, tells us how to do so, and builds thematically to its most powerful message. That message is Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as you love yourself. It is one of the most powerful of all moral instructions, and it lies at the heart of the religious spirit in life. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. This remarkable section comes in the precise center of the middle book of the Torah, Vayikra, Leviticus. Kiddushim, the holiness code, is in the middle of the middle of the Torah. It forms the heart of our most sacred text. And at the heart of the heart, if you will, is the ethical injunction to love your neighbor as you love yourself. This concept is an amazing utopian ideal. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. But what does that mean? How do you show another person that you love her or him as much as you love yourself? Is that even possible? In true Jewish fashion, the Torah does not make this simply an idealistic declaration and hope people figure out how to live up to it. It is instead worked into a practical imperative. Kiddushim builds up to this magnificent commitment with a series of ethical injunctions. Leave a corner of your field for the poor and stranger. Don't leave a stumbling block before the morally blind. Care for the widow and orphan. Be honest in your business dealings. Have equal weights and measures. Be holy because God is holy. That is, be ethical, because that's the heart of holiness. Kiddushim teaches us that the way to love your neighbor is by treating him or her both fairly and honestly. It is that pragmatic approach to love that is just so Jewish. We are not obligated to convert our neighbors to our own views. We are not obligated to save our neighbors from their own belief systems. We are not obligated to change our neighbors into carbon copies of us. We are not required to condemn our neighbors because they are different from us. Rather, we are commanded to treat them as we would wish to be treated, respectfully, honorably, honestly, charitably, ethically, generously. Frankly, this is exactly what our society today needs. This is love of one's neighbor expressed in a functional, healthy world. Not coercion, but concern. Not compulsion, but care. Not elitism, but egalitarianism. May we learn to shape our own public life in these ways. And may we come to do this speedily and soon. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Marvin Heyer, will tell us how he built a non-governmental organization with influence around the world, cultivating tolerance and understanding and fighting anti-Semitism. And we'll learn about the new museum the Wiesenthal Center is building in Jerusalem. Hear about it when we return on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, General David Goldfein was appointed the second Jew ever to command the U.S. Air Force. Goldfein has been the Vice Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force since August. He'll be the first Jewish combat pilot to hold this top position. He's the second Jewish man in the post, following Norton Schwartz, who was Air Force Chief of Staff from 2008 to 2012. His new position makes him one of the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including the top officers of the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and National Guard. The Joint Chiefs are the top military advisors to the President and Secretary of Defense. General Goldfein, born in 1961, my year, is a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, a battle-tested F-16 pilot with more than 4,200 hours flying combat aircraft. He participated in operations in Iraq and the Balkans while flying a combat mission over Serbia, fighting ethnic cleansing in 1999. Goldfein was shot down by a service-to-air missile. He ejected and evaded enemy patrols until a rescue helicopter picked him up. Annually, on the anniversary of his rescue, Goldfein sends each member of the helicopter crew a bottle of good quality single malt scotch to show his continuing appreciation. In other Washington news, a bipartisan group of congressmen and women introduced a resolution calling on Germany to provide additional financial aid to Holocaust survivors in their waning years. The resolution was introduced in the House and Senate last week to ensure all Holocaust victims live with dignity, comfort, and security in their remaining years. It calls on Germany to reaffirm its commitment to this goal through a financial commitment to comprehensively address the unique health and welfare needs of vulnerable Holocaust victims, including home care and other medically prescribed needs. Representatives Ted Deutsch and Ileana Ross-Latinen and Senators Bill Nelson and Susan Collins sponsored the resolution, which cites Germany's moral and historical responsibility to the Holocaust survivors. There are still 100,000 Holocaust survivors living in the U.S., as well as 500,000 in the rest of the world. All have increasing health and welfare needs that require assistance. The resolution follows an exchange between members of Congress and the German finance ministry in which the German government acknowledged recent experience has shown that the care financed by the German government to date is insufficient, and it is imperative to expand these assistance measures quickly given the advanced age of the affected persons. Germany is currently negotiating with the Claims Conference, the umbrella organization for restitution, to address the funding gaps. The resolution was introduced into Congress just before President Barack Obama arrived for a visit to Germany and shortly before Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, this coming Thursday, May 5th.
and a book about Israeli cuisine, won Book of the Year at the prestigious James Beard Awards for food writing. Michael Solomonoff and Stephen Cook's Zaha of A World of Israeli Cooking won Book of the Year and was also named Best Book in the International category at the James Beard Foundation's 2016 Book, Broadcast, and Journalism Awards in New York. Solomonoff, an Israeli-American, and Cook run the popular award-winning Israeli restaurant Zahav in Philadelphia that opened in 2008. Zahav is part cookbook and part memoir. Solomonoff is also the 2011 James Beard Award winner for Best Chef in the Mid-Atlantic region. In addition, Nopi, the cookbook, co-authored by Israeli celebrity chef Yotam Ottolenghi, won the Cooking from a Professional Point of View category at the Beards. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Marvin Heyer. He is the dean and founder of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, which is an NGO, actually, with the status of a non-governmental organization, in addition to having a museum and many components. Tell us a little bit about the organization of the Wiesenthal Center now. It has evolved over time.
Well, today, the Wiesenthal Center, we have, of course, the Wiesenthal Center deals with social actions, combating anti-Semitism, defending Israel, speaking out against racism and hatred around the world, combating terrorism. Its educational arm is the Museum of Tolerance. We are also building a larger facility in the center of Jerusalem that will be called the Museum of Tolerance Jerusalem, that is now in the final stages of construction and will be open to the public, we hope, in late 2017. And then we have a film division called Mariah Films, because today, you know, it's very good. We can open a Holocaust museum or a Museum of Tolerance in a big city like Los Angeles. What about small towns and community colleges? What about areas where there are hardly any Jews in the United States or Canada? A film can travel everywhere. It doesn't have to...
Everywhere in the world,
and
actually,
with Netflix, right. It's just, just a touch of the button, and there it is. So we have a film division. We named it Moriah, because that's where the Jews made their entrance into the world, on Mount Moriah. And we tell the epic events of the 20th and 21st century. And what is unique about Moriah Films is that an A-list Hollywood star donates their talent and narrates it. Why do we do it that way? Because it's easier to gain not only a commercial success, it's easier to gain access to a wider audience when you have somebody, I would say, for example, Yankel Friedman is narrating the thing. He doesn't have the same cachet as Orson Welles, as Michael Douglas. And so that's why we do it the other way around. And we've produced 14. We have two more that we're producing as we speak. We're in production on a film on Ben-Gurion, immediately to be followed. We just signed a contract with Shimon Peres of telling his life story. So there'll be Ben-Gurion and Shimon Peres, two separate documentaries coming out, one this year and the next one in a year and a half from now. We train police. We train public school teachers. We are both, if you say to me, what's the biggest success of the Museum of Tolerance, I would say that 95% of all of our visitors are non-Jews. And because that shows that the message resonates well beyond the Jewish community.
So you're the only rabbi I know with two Oscars. Are you aware of any others that have won Oscars?
The Academy says I'm the only member of the clergy to have ever won an Academy Award. So I'm proud of that. I know my parents, my mother used to like the movies. We were born on the Lower East Side. And she would quell, believe me, I never expected it. And the name of my book is Meant to Be, because I really believe that in key moments of my life, things happened which were... I'll give you an example. We didn't know anyone. We started the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And we didn't know if it would be a success. We had no members or anything. Today we have 400,000 members. One day, while we're trying to figure out how we're going to do this, I get a call from Mickey Rudin. And he says he's Frank Sinatra's lawyer. And I said, I couldn't believe it, because, and he says, you may be getting a call from Frank in the next 2 hours. Are you going to be in your office? I said, yes. And I started to thank him. Oh, he said, don't thank me. I told him he's crazy. He said, what are you starting? He read in a Jewish paper that you're starting, that you want to start the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles. And I said, Frank, are you crazy? How do you know they're going to be a success? Why do you want to get involved now? These people can be a total failure. 2 hours later, approximately, he called me, invited me to his home. And there, my wife and I went to his home, and this is exactly what happened. From out of the blue, he says like this, calls in his neighbor, Danny Schwartz. And he says, bring your Jewish directory. He says, I'm only an honorary Jew. When Danny Schwartz came in, he said, who can we call? And he picked a name from Florida, called up this person who was having to be Don Sofa. And Sinatra got on the line and said to him, we're starting the Simon Wiesenthal Center. I need your help. And I'm going to send down my rabbi, Rabbi Chaya. And he chaired four of our dinners, was a major contributor to the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and opened the doors of the entertainment community to the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And his lawyer was advising him, don't do it.
I remember singing at a Cantor's concert in Palm Springs and sitting in the seat and realizing it had been donated by Frank Sinatra. His connection to the Jewish community has not been documented enough, I think. It's really incredible. The Wiesenthal Center, the Museum of Tolerance, was really the first important Holocaust museum in America. There are now others. There's
right.
even another
oh,
one
sure.
in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you helped to sow the ground for those?
I think without a doubt. I think that the United States, it was
the United States,
States Holocaust Memorial in 1979, right. 2 years later, when the president, under President Carter, I believe, it started.
Right.
And it evolved today as one of the major Holocaust institutions in the entire world, without a doubt. And I think, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, as I said before, our social actions agenda, in addition to the Museum of Tolerance. Today, we have to look after another issue, which is the double standard leveled on the State of Israel. That the State of Israel is today held to a higher standard. Some people would say, well, it should be held to a higher standard.
Right.
But the point of the matter is that it's interesting that no other nation... you have a BDS movement that challenges Israel, boycott, divest, sanctions against Israel, ignoring the entire Arab world, whatever is going on with ISIS, the UN Human Rights Council, all their resolutions. They would go out of business if one day somebody said, we have to give Israel a sabbatical of 2 years. The United Nations Human Rights Council would have to close, because that's all they do is lambast Israel.
Something like 80% of the
80% of all their resolutions are...
anti-Israel, that's correct. You founded not the Museum of the Holocaust in Los Angeles, but the Museum of Tolerance. Can you explain how that came about?
That came about, there was a big debate. Simon Wiesenthal's position was always, the Jews were the principal target of Hitler, but we were not the only targets. Now, what should we learn from that? That we should build a coalition of the victims. He also believed very strongly that Jews, we like to think that we are a very large population, but there are only 14 million of us today on this planet. How could 14 million people survive in a planet that will shortly approach, who knows, 10 billion? Right now we're at 6 or 7, and we're climbing.
7.5
on our way to 10.
Right.
And we're 14 million people without friends. And you can't tell only our story. If the facts of history are gypsies, homosexuals suffered, Slavs suffered, Poles suffered, and today in the world, Rwanda, Biafra, all the genocides, look what's happening in Syria, look what's happening in Iraq, the innocent civilians. So if all we do is tell the story of the Jewish people and limit ourselves to that, we preclude our ability to build coalitions. And we desperately, more than any other people, need coalitions because there are only 14 million of us. So one of the great things that one of the greatest accomplishments of the Museum of Tolerance that we take pride in is when they tell us that 95% of our visitors are non-Jews, I thrill. Because I believe that that is building a coalition of friends who feel that. And why is that? Because when they come to the Museum of Tolerance, they're not only learning the story of Auschwitz, they're learning about racism. They're learning about what happened to African Americans. That African Americans sat at the end of the bus, there were separate lines and
separate bathrooms.
Right. And this is a very important message that, you know, if we isolate ourselves and only tell our own story, we will always be onto ourselves and onto ourselves in a big world. It'd be very lonely.
I wish we had more time. I want to ask a final question. What's the most surprising thing? You had many beshared things, as you say, you know, meant to be in the title of your memoir. What's the most surprising thing that's happened to you in your career?
Well, the most is the fact I was born on the Lower East Side. Most of my friends were religious. I never knew there were so many fine people that were not Orthodox. That I learned in Vancouver when I was a pulpit rabbi. And it changed my whole world view. Now, let me make it very clear. If not for the East Side, I couldn't have accomplished anything. Whatever I may have accomplished, I gained on the streets of the Lower East Side. But I broadened the view by seeing the world of reality when I went to Vancouver. And to me, the greatest lesson was the words of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He said, in the most remarkable interpretation, and that the covenant of Abraham is defined in a single verse. In Hebrew, it's Hu Yoshev El Pesach Ha'Oel Kechom Hayom, and he sat at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. But he was recovering from circumcision. You would expect him to sit in the back of the tent. And he answers, Jews, no matter what the condition, must always position themselves at the entrance of the tent to engage the world, to contribute to the world, and never to retreat in the back of the tent and surrender and not to fully do our commitment as a person created an image, a person created in the image of God. According to Rabbi Soloveitchik, yes, even in the heat of the day, after the Holocaust, after the double standards, Jews should always find themselves at the entrance of the tent, making great contributions to mankind and never retreating.
I want to thank Rabbi Marvin Heyer, who has certainly made such a contribution with the Wiesenthal Center, the Museum of Tolerance, the new Museum of Tolerance in Jerusalem. His book is called Meant to Be a Memoir. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for joining us this morning here on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be U.S. Senator John McCain of Arizona. In this period between Passover and Shavuot, during the Sfirat HaOmer, there's an extra prayer we chant every night of these 7 weeks. It includes a famous passage, Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash. May the temple be rebuilt speedily in our day. It's a metaphor for what we wish in our own lives during this time of year. May we continually seek to rebuild ourselves and so work to rebuild our world. Our playout this morning comes from the four Jewish tenor cantors, Avram Fried, Yitzchak Meir Helfgott, Dudu Fischer, and Ohad Moskovitz, singing Sheyabona Beis HaMikdash, a composition by Israel Shore, made famous by cantor Moshe Kusevitzky. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray,
of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.